Mr. Henderson, Reel 7. Whilst you were at Stainton and as part of your training, were you taught anything about German tanks?
We weren't told the workings of them. We knew that they had an 88mm gun that was renowned for its firing, you know, what it could do and what it couldn't do. It was supposed to be the finest gun in the world. But what we know, the Tiger and the King Tiger were very, very heavily armoured, and the only thing to do with them would be to shoot the tracks off them, and even that wouldn't put the gun out of action. I've known chaps that have put three rounds at point blank range into the front of a Tiger, and they just laughed at him, and just bounced off. At point blank range, a friend of mine was telling me. And suddenly found it was on fire, and he got out. And when they went back next day with a fresh tank, it was wedged in a passage, in an arch. It had backed out and gone. It had never done any damage. And we had round the walls in the training regiment for tank recognition. I think if anyone ever saw a tank, King Tiger, the best thing to do would be to scoot, because you hadn't much chance. Not on your own. We used to think it took about five British tanks to knock one of them out. You know, like five little ships round a big one, scuttling round, one of them might put it down, but one to one, you hadn't much chance. They were so heavily armoured, and the guns were so big, they'd go right through one of ours, which was a good thing. The worst thing of a shell getting into a tank would be not to be able to get out the other side, but to spin around inside and kill everything that was in. That was the worst part of it.
Were you becoming aware, I know it's early stages, but were you becoming aware that the Germans had a superiority in tank fire?
No. No, I don't think we ever did. We were young and we were daft, and there was nobody in the world as good as us. This was our attitude, and we were full of life, and this is how it was. I mean, we were British and proud of it, and God help the Germans when we found them. We couldn't get at them quick enough.
So at Stainton camp, you were doing very much down to earth, you know, training with tanks, wireless, what have you. Was there any other duties there, or any other learning techniques that you were picking up?
The radio, I say we only did the one guard. Some of them were doing other guards, the ones that had the hut. The marching and the drill. There was the spud bashing, and the call had to be, the call fatigues. There was quite a lot of fatigues, which fortunately I was not involved in. I think that's all. It was mostly training.
Remember, at this camp, do you remember any of the NCOs that you were working with or were working with you?
I just remember that wireless chap, and I can't think of his name.
Again, were officers seen a great deal? Were you seeing much of the officers?
The only officer I really saw was the chief instructor, and he often pop in. He was often sneaking in wherever you were to keep his eye on how the training was going, and talk to the corporal or whoever was doing this. There were little classrooms. It was just like attending school. It was like a college. It was like a naval college. You went round different classrooms and you were all busy at work. And then you went out in a tank to do practical work. But you did a lot of the work inside the classrooms.
Did you get any visits from anyone important? Generals or
don't think so.
Politicians?
Not at Barnard Castle. Can't remember anyone coming. I mean, there was quite a lot of troops at Barnard. I reckon there was about 36,000 troops here then. And just down the road, of course, was Catterick, which was another very big training place. So there was a lot of training going on at that particular time.
And how long were you at Stainton?
Stainton. Altogether, we were there about 6 months. So 5 weeks. 5 weeks and then a 10-day leave. 6 weeks.
Just over 4 months.
Yes. It's Stainton.
And at the end of that, you were.
At the end of that, we had to We had to wait. We were passed out. We were passed out, and we were put on a short notice for moving out. And we were back up to Streatham again. And I think I had to move back into billets then. I think. And then we were waiting instructions of where to go to. And then each day someone would come and say, well, there's so many batches going away today. And there was a little railway station near Streatham camp called Brumilaw. And it was a halt that had been opened for the Streatham Castle, for the Queen Mother's family when she was living there. She lived at Streatham Castle. And so we marched down to that halt, caught the train and went to Darlington, and from there we went wherever we had to go.
You've been assigned your regiment now.
So I was assigned, I was assigned to the 1318th Royal Hussars, stationed at Skipton. So the day came when four of us had to leave to join the regiment. And we went to Darlington, and then from there we caught a train to Skipton. I can't remember all the details of how we travelled there, but we eventually arrived at Skipton Station, and we were met by a Corporal George and a vehicle. And there was just the four of us, and he took us to regimental headquarters. And there we were assigned our squadrons, and we were, or temporary squadron, whatever, and our cap badges, and then, although we didn't realise it at the time, we joined a family that today, 50 years later or more, is still very much in existence. I had a letter this morning from one of the family, one of the boys. We're still in touch with, there's not many of us still surviving, but it's been a family and still is a family.
What date was this when you got to the regiment?
When I got to the regiment was about March 43.
How were you feeling about how the war was going? Because obviously as a pre-war, before a pre-army, before you came into it, it was a losing end.
Well, we were certainly never depressed about it. Whether we were just naive or what, I don't know. We probably were, but we had every faith in ourselves. We certainly didn't worry. We should have done, but we didn't. We did a lot of training with the regiment. Never doubted for a minute that we were going to win the war. That never entered into it, that we'd ever lose. Never even thought about losing the war. But when we finally got to France, I think we were still very naive, even on the boats, that what we were going to do when we got there. There was fear there as well, but there was no hatred or anything. It was just, I can't explain, it was just one of those things. But the hatred came afterwards, when a lot of your friends had been killed, and this is when the... You just wanted to knock them out.
We'll come to that, of course. So you arrived at Skipton. How were you received?
We were received very, very well indeed, because at that time the regiment had been in India for many years, and they were all sweats. And when you went into the mess, you were very surprised, because everyone was speaking Hindustani. There was a lot of English words mixed up with Hindustani words. They were all old sweats. We were the young, innocent, very innocent young soldiers. But there was a lot of us. So we were... And eventually the older ones were moved out to training regiments as batmen or things like that, or instructors. And it became a young regiment.
What's the background to the regiment? Were you told where it was formed from? What was its recruitment area?
Its recruitment area is Barnsley. The 13th, 18th Hussars amalgamated in 1922. Both those Hussars had done a lot of service together. In the relief of Ladysmith, one of the regiments, the 13th, was in there, and it was relieved by the 18th. They were very close in a lot of it, a lot of the campaigns. There were the Battle of Balaclava, charge of the Light Brigade. Lord Baden-Powell was colonel of the regiment at one time. The Duke of Wellington was also colonel of the regiment at one time. It's a top-notch cavalry regiment, and we're very proud to be in it. A lot of the boys went to yeomanry regiments, like the Essex Yeomanry, which were only wartime. They were like territorial regiments. But we were lucky to get into a regiment that was a first-class cavalry regiment, and we were... The discipline was so high, it was vicious. You got for the least little thing, you got into trouble. You were highly trained, highly disciplined. It was so bad at one time that I volunteered for the Palestine Police, and the glider pilots I volunteered for. Everyone was putting in for, because what we called the spit and polish. We had another word for it, but it was spit and polish. It was just obscene. We didn't think that during the war there was any need for it. But we would never... Nobody ever got sent out of the regiment. We were kept there. And
it wasn't a bullying aspect, though, was it? That
yes.
Was coming in? It was.
What, bullying?
In the sense of the strictness and the severity.
It wasn't bullying. No, it wasn't bullying. There was no bullying at all. They were smashing lads. I mean, the corporal. But they had a job to do when they did it, you know. Little Corporal Beswick, he was killed. A lovely little chap, had two daughters. But if we were late on parade, he had no option but to put us on a charge. It wasn't his fault. And so when we went on a charge, we got 7 days, and we had to report with full button at Rivali at the guard room. The provost sergeant was a very, very badly liked. I think they all are. But this particular chap was dead now. Absolutely hated by everyone.
What was his name?
Galooly. He was from Stoke-on-Trent. And he apparently was a dustbin man. Or he worked for the council or the dustbins. And he couldn't write his own name. And a friend of mine, Alec Jury, was at once... his name was taken, and what was his number? And he read a number off a vehicle that was behind Galooly, and he gave him that off a wagon. He just read it out. And Carmichael, or any long name you can think about, if you gave him that, he said, well, don't do it again, because he couldn't spell it. He was so thick. But there you go. He was the only one in the regiment that no one liked. That was his job, provost sergeant. And he was a bit of a pig, if you ever came under him, which fortunately I never did.
Was it strict but fair? You didn't feel as though you were unfairly treated?
Well, when you say strict but fair, when you went out... Now, we had an RSM called Duffy Hahn. He was strict but fair, very strict, and a very nice chap. And he died about 4 years ago.
What was his name again?
Duffy Hind. Joined the regiment he'd been in the army 25 years when war broke out. He'd been in the army 25 years. And he was a regimental sergeant major. The first time I saw him was at Skipton. And he had a trench coat on and a flat hat, officer's type, and his swagger stick. And I saluted him at Skipton Marketplace. And in front of all and sundry in Skipton Market, he gave me the awfulest dressing down at the top of his voice. And he was only a foot away from me. That next time he saw me, I would know that he wasn't a bloody officer, you know. And that was my first meeting with Mr. Hind. New Year's Day in 45, I was in an old mill, and he brought me a pot of tea. There was two of us sleeping. His driver was sleeping with me in an old mill in Holland. And he brought two pint pots of tea. And he said, right, lad, you can always say that the RSM has brought you a cup of tea into bed. So strict but fair. Now, when you reported to him on a Saturday afternoon when you went out on the Passion Wagon, which cost you sixpence, to go into the nearest big town from Wickham Market, where we were at. After Skipton, went to Wickham Market. The nearest big town was Ipswich. So we had to go on the Passion Wagon. It cost us sixpence, return, in the back of a lorry. And you had to report to the regimental office, and he, Mr. Hand would come out, and you lifted your shoes, your boots up, your shoes up at the back, and if they were worn down at the heel, go back and get your boots on. Well, you knew that you couldn't go then, because the wagon wouldn't wait, and you had nearly a mile to walk back to your hut. So that was, you weren't allowed out with if your heels were down in your civvy shoes. Now, you couldn't go and buy a pair of civvy shoes at that time, because they were on ration, and you had to get points, ration book points, and the only way you could get those was through your families. Your families gave you these to get a pair of shoes. So you could, and you could get them repaired, but you couldn't buy any.
Was there a great deal, therefore, of inspections of one kind or another?
There were always inspections, going on? All continuous. Of course, you got away with a lot. We had PT on the morning at 6:30. By this time, we were getting to be old sweats, or old soldiers, or we're getting to know the ropes and feel our feet a bit. We'd learned to crawl, and now we're starting. We'd learned to walk, and now we're learning to run. So when he came in for PT on the morning, he opened the door. The hut had two doors, one at the top, one at the bottom. By this time, there was single bunks. There weren't double tier. And there was about 20 in a room, or more, 20, so 25. And they would open the door, out RMPT, and when we all jumped out of bed, I used to run out the back the other door, and hide round the corner, and off, and threw a few more wood, and off they'd go on PT, and we'd get back into bed. And that went on for a few mornings, until eventually we were caught at it. Nothing happened. We didn't get put on the charge. We were told if we did it again, we would be. But the spit and polish was terrific. Absolutely. Cavalry. We were cavalry. Downstairs I have the book about the regimental standing orders. You had to stand to attention to a trained soldier. We never did. But before the war, up until the war, you had stood to attention to a trained soldier or a lance corporal. They were telling me that they used to clean the spurs by putting them in the oat bin. But if you were ever caught, it was a court-martial offence for cleaning the spurs in the corn, but it was a marvellous way to clean them. And the spit and polish before they were in the regiment with the horses was always... But when they were out in India, they all had batmen. It was shaved before they woke up in the morning, and all the kit was cleaned by the Indian batman for a few rupees a week, you know, a few annas a week. But we had all ours to do. But some of the old soldiers, Harry, one particular chap, was in our room, Harry. And he would clean your kit for half a crown if you were pushed, you know. And we had the old soldiers would do this, you know. He never cleaned mine, I always cleaned my own. But some of these that had more money than sense would get theirs done, and I think that was cheating.
Was there a strong cavalry link running throughout the regiment, although it was on tanks?
Yes, yes.
How did that manifest itself?
Well, we were all called donkey wallopers. That was it. It was the words of command, mount. But when you fell in. In front of your tank, and the order when you were told to mount, it was just like mounting a horse. Advance, when you were told to move off through your earphones, if you were driving, driver, advance. There were cavalry orders, and the charge and all this. There were just more or less cavalry orders. And the officers used to walk. They all had the horses, you know. They still had the horses, and some of the batmen had to look after these horses. and they used to walk about in knee breeches and things, some of the officers, and the RSM was a horse rider, and some of the other sergeant majors that were cavalry men. And they said one of the punishments, one of the main punishments, was 3 weeks riding school, was a punishment before the war. 3 weeks on riding school, and they rode until the thighs were bleeding.
So this cavalry mentality, do you feel that it found its way into the action situation as well?
Well, I'm sure it did. Yes. We developed after we'd got over in 43, it was a tough year for the spit and polish. What we call mobilisation, where you're getting mobilised to go into action. It was that little, what you might call a Cold War period, where we didn't know what was happening. The regiment was getting brought up to strength. We were getting new boys from the training regiment, and you weren't going to start training the regiment until they were all there. And it was that period where we were there, and we were messing about doing a lot of spit and polish, idle hands, as it were. The devil finds work for idle hands, or whatever. So when we went into town, we had to be highly polished and very respectable. If you ever did anything wrong in the town, to bring the honourable name of the regiment, dear me, it was a terrible thing, terrible offence. The regiment was so proud of themselves so much that you had to keep the honour of the regiment. This is how we were taught all the way. And then eventually all the lads came. We were a full regiment and a full... We got rid of all the ones that were too old for fighting or weren't needed or couldn't change from horses to tanks. You know, they wanted young men that were mechanically minded straight from the tank training regiments and then forged them into a fighting unit. Once that started, and then they sent some of them to Castle Martin to learn to shoot, and then it started to become interesting. And then we started to get our vehicles waterproofed, and we knew then what was going to happen.
Before that, I did ask you about what the squadron was. How many squadrons were there in the regiment?
Four. ABC and HQ.
And then, as you say, there were five troops.
Yes.
Five troops per squadron?
There was at the training regiments. HQ had different troops that had troops of recce tanks and transport troops and things like that. What we called a fighting squadron, A squadron, B squadron, C squadron. The name for those was Sabre Squadron. But you asked about whether the name for a cavalry, there were... If you were in a Sabre squadron, you were in a fighting squadron. And this was the name given to pre-war, or cavalry. They were in Sabre squadrons.
So you have your squadrons per regiment, and then your troops. Within the troops themselves, did all the troops have the same vehicle, tank?
Yes.
And the same gun power?
Yes.
That's right.
All the troops had the same number of men in a tank, five, and the same number of tanks in a troop, five, and all you were in first, second, third, fourth, or fifth troop. And even now, when you meet them, what troop? I was in third troop, he's gone. Oh, yes, that's right. But even now, you don't forget what. They were all the same.
Was there a recce element to the regiment?
Yes, that was in HQ, recce troop. Now, they didn't have the same tanks. They had Honey, or the Stuart, little Stuart, Honey Stuart, the same tank, an American tank. Before that, they had armoured cars, scout cars we had for intercom, the little Dingo, Daimler scout cars, for running in between tanks with messages, or talking to the infantry. You'd get onto one of the little scout cars, they would probably liaise with the infantry. They were the intercom. Oh, that was intercom troop. There was also a recce troop with these little tanks. It started off with little scout cars. And then they went on to these little, with the tucks on, these, what the infantry had, found to be no use at all.
But those are carriers?
Like little carriers. Like carriers. They were, tried everything. And then they finally, for D-Day, went on to the little Stuart tanks. But the casualty rate among those was very, very high. They only had a 37mm gun on, very small gun on, very small, very thinly armoured, very light for speed. And they went ahead to recce to see what was going on, get clobbered, and there was one case of three tanks that lined up with the heavies to go into attack. And they said, you'll never see that again. They were all wiped out. And they're all buried at Hermanville Cemetery in a line. That little Corporal Beswick was one of them.
And these were three honeys that went in.
They were all the honeys. They just were, it was just, and the captain in the Hardy, lieutenant, got the MC. Hardy, that was on the 10th of June, 44. He died on the 14th. He died of wounds. But they had no chance, you know.
A recce unit. What about emergency repair unit, you know, for initial breakdowns?
Well, we had our own regimental fitters who had ordinary tanks with no turret on. And they were recovery vehicles. We also, in charge of that, we had a sergeant major who was from Barnard Castle, called Spencer. Who had a blacksmith shop. He was in the regiment before the war as a fitter. And he lived over the bridge in Stafford. He had a blacksmith shop there.
Talking about the actual maintenance of your tanks, really, and you did have a maintenance element there.
Oh, very much. When we were in England, if you drove your tank for a mile, I think you were maintaining it for three hours. The Sherman tank was a very, very reliable tank. Not like the Germans. Although the Germans were a good tank, they were unreliable. But ours were very reliable, and they were greased every day. All your tracks and everything were greased every night when you pulled in, every night.
And did you do this, too?
Yes. We had two drivers, and they did it every night. They were well maintained. They were easy to maintain. And of course, you had to fuel up every day. You had a 50-gallon tank, which would only take you about not much more than 50 miles. Between 50 and 60 miles was your range, without a filling up. And there were a Chrysler engine, petrol, with the 30-cylinder, a radio of five banks of six. But they were very reliable.
The gun, what gun did they fire?
75mm.
How efficient was that?
That was very good and very accurate. It was a good gun. It didn't have the range or the firepower of the 88, but it was the best we'd ever had. And then, one to a troop, they brought in the Sherman with a 17-pounder on, called a Firefly. That was a British 17-pounder that they fitted onto a Sherman. They took one crew out. The second driver was taken out. And that space was used for bigger ammunition, because we had to use that for. But that was on par with the 88. That was very good.
And they would have taken the turret off, presumably.
No, the turret was still there. It was just a bigger gun, a bigger barrel, bigger gun, same turret and everything. Just the fitted, and they came from England, one to a troop.
Had the Sherman any faults at all?
Well, the main fault he had. The German called it the Tommy Cooker, because as soon as it was hit, it used to almost certainly set on fire, because it was all electric. And the fumes in there, the petrol fumes, you wouldn't dare smoke in a Sherman, in any tank, especially these petrol jobs. And the fumes were very, very prone to what we call brew up. And that was what the name the Germans used, Tommy Cookers. That was the main fault with them.